It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the writer behind the famous play A Raisin in the Sun. She's the latest in our Wisconsin Legends series.
It is the first day of spring today. People of Wisconsin rejoice because today, at least by the calendar, winter is over. So have a cheese curd, a beer, whatever makes you feel good, because this year we've earned it.
Yeah, it's not quite as warm as it looked out there when I went out for lunch. It was still pretty chilly, so I'm not going to rush out and celebrate, and neither is the State Assembly. They're in a marathon session today, hoping to wrap up business on a number of bills before the end of this year's legislative session.
WPR State Government reporter Sean Johnson joins us now. He's at the Capitol with the latest on what's happening. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So one of the bills that's getting a lot of attention this time around is the chemotherapy bill. Could you catch us up on that?
Yeah, some developments on that one today. This is a bill that I'm not sure many people were following until a couple weeks ago when the Senate Republican leader, Scott Fitzgerald, used highly unusual parliamentary trick to keep it from getting a vote there. That kind of got people's attention, and suddenly the bill was on the calendar of the Senate this week, passed 30-2. There was some question about what the Assembly might do. If they amended it, there was a chance that, you know, that could effectively kill the bill if the Senate didn't go along. They have decided they are going to amend it, but it looks like this is an amendment that has advocates for cancer treatment on board. And what it would do is basically cap co-payments for oral chemotherapy. That's, you know, chemotherapy that you take with a pill at home. It would cap co-payments to that at $100 per month. And so, again, cancer advocates were there saying that, this is still a big victory for us. $100 is fair. It's kind of the upper limit of what they wanted to look at as far as copay goes, but they're in the support of the bill.
Now, advocates there are saying that a lot of the latest treatment in terms of chemotherapy are coming in the form of pills, of oral treatment chemotherapy, and that legislation needed to reflect that, and that some of the money needed to be used to help pay for those drugs.
Exactly. And really, it's been insurance companies who fought this, and because they believe it's going to be expensive. But we'll have to see. I actually haven't seen where, they're going to end up on this amendment. You know, there was some talk that their opposition would be relaxed if you had this copayment. I haven't seen that yet. But, it does look like something that is probably going to pass the Assembly later today or in the wee hours of the morning. You know, not sure, but this is something where we might have, a big bipartisan vote potentially.
Now, another matter before the Assembly, this one's been controversial. This pertains to early voting. What's going on there?
Yeah, this would cap early voting or, in-person absentee voting at the city clerk's office to 45 hours a week in the 2 weeks preceding an election. It would also ban weekend early in-person absentee voting at the clerk's office. This is something that the Assembly already approved last year. The Senate took it up, added an amendment that would require the state to pick up half the costs of municipalities who, pay people extra for early voting. The Assembly says it's going to go along with those changes. And so, that's going to be a bill that's headed to the governor's desk. That's one that where the governor has very consistently not taken a position. You know, he's even when he was asked in front of a friendly Republican crowd last night that, you would assume was largely in support of the bill, the governor took a pass on saying where he stood on it, and he's been pretty consistent on that. But, you can imagine, given the strong Republican votes it's received so far in the legislature, it's probably something he would support. Democrats don't like this because they say it's basically targeted at Madison and Milwaukee, cities that turn out a lot of Democratic voters and that use early voting extensively.
Now, Republicans, as you said, have been the ones driving this one. What have they been saying about why it's necessary?
They say it's about uniformity and that it will make sure that smaller municipalities that don't have the resources that a Madison or a Milwaukee have and can't do this early voting to the degree that Madison or Milwaukee have, that they're not put at a disadvantage. The counter to that is that, you know, in those smaller municipalities, those longer hours aren't necessarily needed because they don't have the issues that the big cities do with lines on election day.
And there's another one out there related to elections, a bill that already passed in the Senate, and it would give lobbyists more time during election years to make financial contributions to lawmakers and other candidates. What's going on here? Why is this popping up now?
Yeah, this is something that advocates have said is, you know, a good idea this year because Wisconsin is moving up its primary schedule. It used to have a primary in September that's getting moved up to August. This bill would move up when a lobbyist can write a direct check to a lawmaker from June to April. The counter to that argument from groups that advocate for campaign finance reform is basically that we need this like we need, you know, another few months of winter. There's no reason to, you know, nobody's clamoring for more lobbyists writing checks to lawmakers earlier in the year. And that this is, you know, something that only a legislator could support.
Now, moving away from elections to another hot-button area, schools have been very much in the public eye in the legislature this past session, and school accountability is one that is still out there waiting to be decided. What's the Assembly considering today in regards to that?
This is something where Republicans are really at odds. I mean, this is definitely an internal Republican dispute on how to go forward on this, and it really boils down to whether they're going to take a bill that passed the Senate with pretty broad bipartisan support that would essentially move up the date of when new school report cards cover all schools, voucher schools, and public schools. The Assembly, you know, could take that up, and they would have passed something. And it would go to the governor's desk, and they would have kind of moved this issue forward incrementally. What they're considering, though, is amending that to include punishments for schools that don't meet state standards consistently, including even closing schools, public schools or private voucher schools that don't meet the standards. You know, that has their caucus extremely divided. There are some members who say, you know, look, if we're going to have school accountability that means anything, there has to be sanctions. There have to be punishments. But there are other members who say, if we do this, we're going to get killed for it, and rightly so.
So that one sounds like a toss-up right now. It sounds like anyone's guess.
Yeah, it's one of those where you actually don't know. The script has not yet been written on this one. Normally, when a calendar gets set for the legislature, it's pretty much you pretty much know how things are going to play out. On this particular issue, you don't know if Republicans are going to, basically take the simpler bill and, call it a year, or if they're going to try to pass this more aggressive bill and, you know, maybe go home having passed nothing.
Well, these are just a handful of the bills that are still being wrangled over tonight. It's supposed to be an all-nighter. I assume you've got your pajamas and your toothbrush and everything, and you're going to be settling in. But tell us, if a bill doesn't get moved forward tonight, what happens? How many do you think are going to be left on the table?
If a bill doesn't pass tonight, its chances of becoming law this year, you know, go down several fold. This is sort of a self-imposed deadline. The legislature could be in under the calendar they set at the beginning of this two-year session. They could be in through the first week of April for regular business. The Assembly wants to get things wrapped up, though. The Senate's going to come back in the week of April 1st, and so the Assembly could do the same. So it's not like this is absolutely 100% the last session day, but this is a biggie, and that's why you see the calendar so loaded up with these controversial issues.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot, and good luck getting through the late night tonight.
All right, caffeine is the term.
Caffeine. All right. Well, that was WPR State Government Reporter Sean Johnson getting us caught up on the State Assembly's marathon session taking place right now.
Today's Wisconsin legend is playwright Lorraine Hansberry. She was the first black woman to write a play performed on Broadway. Her best-known work, the play A Raisin in the Sun, centers on the lives of African-Americans living under racial segregation in Chicago.
But before Hansberry became known on Broadway, she was a student at UW-Madison and already devoted to the cause of equal rights for minorities. Here to fill us in on the life and work of Lorraine Hansberry is Sandra Adell, professor of literature in the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with how Hansberry ended up at UW-Madison. When was she here?
She was here in around 1948. And how she ended up here, that's quite a puzzle. I do not know. we don't have any records of any letters that she wrote to friends and family about her choice. I do know that everyone else in her family went to traditionally black colleges. Her parents were from, her mother's from Tennessee, her father was from Mississippi. They were a well-off family by any standards in the 1930s and 1940s. She was born in Chicago. But why she chose Madison, I'm hoping we will find out on April 1st when the Schomburg Center for African and African-American Culture opens up an online archive that have letters that have never been seen before and photographs that have never been published about her.
Yeah. What would have been like for her coming to the UW in that time, in the late 40s?
I can't imagine it, to tell you the truth, especially when you consider the few number of students of color we have here today, what, maybe less than 2,000. She would have been even, there would have been even fewer at the time. Now, I do know that she integrated an all-white woman's dorm while she was here. And she was also a member of what's called the Young Progressives. At one point during her sophomore year, she was the president of that organization. How big it was, I don't know. And I'm hoping, again, that we will find some of that out in the letters that she might have written home to her mother.
So she was already politically active. She said she desegregated a dorm, which is a pretty big thing to do when you're a college student. I wonder also if you know anything about the seeds of her literary career. Were any of those sown while she was here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me back up, though. Her activism and her literary career, those seeds were sown in Chicago. Her family, as I said, were quite well off. Her mother was a school teacher. Her father was a very successful real estate broker. And that family hosted some of the country's most outstanding black intellectuals, including Paul Robeson, who you might have known came here several times in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and also W.E.B. Du Bois, Langston Hughes, among others. So all of those seeds were sown in Chicago, in her home. Her father filed suit, Carl Hansberry filed suit against the restrictive covenants that kept black people out of white communities in Chicago, and won. And that is what made what's called restrictive covenants illegal. And if you don't know what those mean, it is where a group of people will get together, white folks will get together, and sign agreements that become legal and binding that they will not rent or sell to blacks and Jews. And we even had restrictive covenants here in Madison, Wisconsin for many, many years until somebody looked at the laws and said, okay, we're getting rid of these. So this activism then came about as a result of her family environment. That's what she brought to Madison, Wisconsin, with her. All of this upbringing in Chicago.
So there was never a question, maybe in her mind, that she would not continue that activism. She was going to do that right from the start.
Always, yeah.
So where did the literary strand come from? You talked about her being brought up in an activist household. This was something that was part of her makeup. But what about the playwright part of her?
Well, that came as a result of her. When she came to Madison, she thought she was going to go into art education. And then she switched to creative writing. And when she saw Shauna O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock, that's the turning point for her. She saw it in a theater production here. And that's when she decided she wanted to go into playwriting. But even that, the experience of writing, we have to attribute that, to Paul Robeson and the black intellectuals that she met when she left here after her sophomore year and went to New York City.
So Paul Robeson and Lorraine Hansberry, both people who united entertainment, I guess, or popular culture and political activism. They didn't see a distinction between the two, it
absolutely
sounds like.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Interesting.
Do you know whether she encountered any kind of opposition here or whether it was a town that was in a university that was ripe for progressive ideas?
No. Actually, if you look back at the history of blacks in Madison in the early part of the first half of the 20th century and even today to some extent, it was a very hostile environment. So you had to be strong and committed to change. Now, one of the other things I want to point out, though, is Lorraine Hansberry was a lesbian. And around 1950, by 1957, she had joined a group called the Daughters of Elitis, which was in New York City, and started writing for a lesbian feminist paper. Now, think about this. We're talking about prior to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But again, all of this development, she was ripe when it comes to, if you want to use those terms, when she went to New York, because she associated and became immediately involved with the New York intellectual group. She studied and took courses at the New School for Social Research, which was just a repository of intellectual and public intellectual work, not celebrity. Mm-hmm. No, there's a big difference between that. I mean, these people weren't trying to be celebrities. They were trying to be public intellectuals. That their work had to be in the interest of better improving the conditions of all people.
So here in Madison, I don't know how much we know about the story of desegregating that dorm that she led. Was there an instant backlash to that? Did people pick up the idea and agree despite maybe being a hostile environment for a woman of color?
I have no idea. That's what we don't know.
Yeah.
Now, what I do know is that when she – I would like to back up to Chicago because I think there's a part of her history in Chicago that people are not aware of, and that is when in 1938 – when her family, she was 8 years old at the time, moved into an all-white neighborhood, they encountered tremendous violence to the point that they were court-ordered to leave, to move. And that's why her father filed the Hansberry versus Lee lawsuit to protest this restricted covenants. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so, you know, that's a grand example. To what extent, and I don't know if she led, an effort to desegregate. I just think she went in there and said, I'm staying here, period. Mm. So, you know, I don't know how much of a movement or who was behind her here in Madison when she went into that dorm.
Maybe she just refused to be segregated.
Yeah, which is what her parents refused when they said, okay, you want to kick us out of this community? And it was very violent. The whites were very violent against it. We're going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. So that's the kind of fight that she was exposed to all the time in her home and then when she went to New York.
Well, she sounds like an incredibly strong, dynamic person. I had no idea she was at the UW-Madison. What is your sense of her just as a person?
I wish I had known her.
Yeah.
I tell you, I'm very excited. I'm just looking forward to when the archive becomes live on April 1st.
Will you be there?
It's online.
It's online.
It's online. But I do want to point out a couple of other things, and that is she completed The Raisin in the Sun in 1957. It opened on Broadway at the Barrymore Theater in 1959 and ran for 530 performances. Now, there was a couple of important revivals. One was in 2003 with Sean Combs, you know, P. Diddy, as Walter Lee Younger, Felicia Rashad as Lena Younger, and Audra McDonald as Ruth. This is an all-star cast. It's opening again. It's in previews right now at the Barrymore Theater, which is where it opened in 1959, with Denzel Washington as Walter Lee Younger. So this play lives on and on and on. Now, I don't know how much credit we can take for that play, except that she saw something here in Madison. She saw theater here, and that inspired her.
The play, do people watch it now as an artifact of another time, or does it really have a strong resonance with us today?
It resonates with us today because, you know, it's dealing with a family who has suffered the loss of the patriarch, the husband. The father, rather. And it's a family dynamics. The story is about a family dynamics, but they're also moving into a white neighborhood. They're jammed up in this what's called a kitchenette apartment. And life is, they're stifled because there's no space for them to thrive. And so the mother and Mama Younger and Walter Lee are, you know, they're butting heads here. So you've got all of these generational conflicts, but you also have the beginning of her feminism. She's way ahead of her time in creating a character, Benita, who in 1959 wants to be a doctor, not not a nurse. Mm-hmm. And then there's a character named Asage, who's African, Nigerian. And this is the first time we see on stage an intelligent Nigerian or African, somebody from the African continent, who is not, our Tarzan stereotype. Mm-hmm. So she was way ahead of her time.
It sounds fascinating. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
on
you.
And sharing her life with us. We've been talking to Sandra Adele from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about Wisconsin legend Lorraine Hansberry.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an inside look at the people who go to work for Wall Street banks and how the Great Recession changed their world.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ask any parent and they'll tell you raising children is rewarding and challenging.
If you're a new parent, maybe you turn to self-help books for answers to common questions but found that one size doesn't really fit all.
Our next guest decided to shake things up and take a different approach to navigating the twists and turns of modern parenting. Dalton Conley is a professor of sociology at New York University and author of the new book, Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children, But We're Too Exhausted to Ask. Dalton, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
I want to start with your terminology here, parentology. How do you define that?
Well, it's a word I made up, of course, but what it really means is that what I think is a uniquely American style of parenting, which is very improvisational. We don't follow some ancient Chinese or French tradition that's been passed down for thousands of years. We're an immigrant society. We invent things as we go along. And I'm advocating or trying to formalize that approach in this book by suggesting that, yes, we should improvise and adapt to our kids or the unique aspects of our kids, but we should do it with the scientific method in mind and hypothesis testing and trial and revision and trial and error and revision. And then I called it parentology to make it scientific.
Well, you tried lots of stuff that probably comes across as unorthodox to a lot of parents out there, but you were basing what you did on science, and I wonder what is it you wanted to get out of your, I won't say experiments with your children, but as you went along, out of your parentology, what was the result you wanted for your kids?
Well, I come from a position as a scientist where I'm kind of overwhelmed myself by all the science out there. You know, anything you could imagine about your kids' lives has been studied one way or another. For example, having kids in the fall, having them born in the fall, it affects their life expectancy, you know, past age 50, compared to having them positively, compared to having them born in the spring, which is a negative effect. So, you know, for me, I discovered that research study too late. I had my kids at the wrong time of year, but it is quite overwhelming, and I try to argue in the book that any kind of self-help guide that just says, like, here's the 7 points to successful children is selling you snake oil, and really what you need is sort of, I try to show through example the way of just sort of making sense of science and how you might apply it to your own kids. So, for example, I saw they diagnosed my son with ADHD, and the school wanted him to go on to medication, Adderall. And I resisted that because I knew that the science was mixed on whether it actually on long term it works or not. And also just, of course, makes any parent nervous to give a pharmaceutical to their kid. But I did know another research literature that showed that placebo effects were huge. In fact, they were almost as big as the actual treatment, particularly with mental health or psychological or behavioral treatments. So his mother and I went along with it, and we decided to give him a placebo, an herbal pill, and lie to him, to the school, to his sister, to basically the whole social world, thought he was being medicated. And we wanted to see if that worked in terms of solving the attentional issues in school.
Well, what happened?
That particular, I probably shouldn't start with that example because that particular experiment did not work. It worked for about 2 weeks until people said, well, maybe you need to switch the medication. It's not working. And eventually we did give in and get him on ADHD prescription medication. Another example was their names. They have very unusual names, both of my kids. And there's a whole research literature on having a more male name or a more female name, a more unique name, a racially tinged name, what the effects of that are. And I read it as unusual names lead to children learning to control their impulses. If they get teased or something like that, they learn to bite their tongue. And this leads to success. The people with unusual names are disproportionately represented in who's who, for example.
Right, and I guess the science says that people who have better impulse control are a lot more successful, even with people than higher IQs.
Right. That's a very, very in vogue area of research on child development now, what's called non-cognitive skills, that perseverance, impulse control, those kind of skill sets that are not really, they're correlated with your IQ, but they're distinct from it. And some people argue are more important than your actual cognitive ability.
Now, are the names that you give your kids in the book their real names?
They are.
They are. Can you tell us what they are, just to give a sense of how far you went with this?
So my daughter's name is E, just the letter E, no period. We actually thought it was going to stand for something, but we wanted to give her some interactivity there and let her choose what it standed for, what it stood for when she got old enough to make such a decision. But so far, and she's at the peak rebellion time of age 16, she has stuck with E, and she loves it. And my son, well, once you name your first kid E, you really can't name your second kid, John. Or you could, I guess, but we went for another unusual name, and in his name, we kind of confounded ethnic stereotypes. So he's a, blue-eyed white kid, and his name is Yoxing, but he's got a long name, Yoxing Haino Augustus Eisner Alexander Weiser Knuckles. And because his sister got to have some control of her name, two of those names in there were actually ones that he picked himself and legally inserted when he was about 3 or 4. So, yes, they have very unusual names. Everybody in the school knows who they are. They're not confused. And, that has its own effects on their social and emotional development, I think.
Do you think that it's working out the way you planned it, that they are learning impulse control, or is the verdict still out? They're just too young.
Yeah, they have different abilities of impulse control between them, I'd say. But I would say that, even though people who've heard that name, those names have called me a child abuser and other bad words, they both love them. They would not trade them for the world. E, as I mentioned, she could have easily adopted Ellen, which is my mother's name, or Elizabeth or something like that, and she has resisted that. And both of them love their name. So it's part of who they are. And for better or worse. So
yeah.
I do think it has had a slightly positive effect on them, but again, there's no control group.
One of the things I wonder about is the limitations of science. You're going to the scientific literature, you're looking at what's really out there. I assume you're looking for quality studies that really seem to say something that's been well researched. But science changes. If you look at, the only example I can think of off the top of my head is nuts. Maybe 10 years ago, nuts were going to kill you and you shouldn't eat them. And now nuts are being touted as a health food. Is the same true of the science on parenting, that if you run with one of these things, it might be just overturned in a year?
That is true. The science completely, changes over time. I'll give you a more risque example, circumcision. So at the time that my son was born, the fashion among highly educated individuals, in fact, the recommendation of the American Pediatric Association was not to circumcise, that the pain and so forth involved to a young infant, they in fact showed that it changed their pain reactivity 6 months or a year or even 2 years later. So it was a traumatic event and had lasting psychological consequences. Okay, so that kind of, on that science just made the decision. But then about 5 or 6 years later, there were huge trials going on in Africa to look at the effect of circumcision on transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, specifically AIDS, and they found that circumcision was an incredibly successful way of cutting down males acquiring HIV and other viruses. And it was so stark and so dramatic, the science, that they actually called off the, you know, the treatment and control group and offered the service to anybody because they thought it would be unethical to keep going. And so, you know, so they're now I don't know where the American Pediatric Association stands, but basically now that science has been overturned, and you know, we go back to, you know, the Old Testament, and Abraham was right, I guess. And who knows, in 5 years again, they may say don't circumcise. So clearly, you know, it's a shifting landscape, and enough to make anybody, any parent or researcher for that matter, a little crazy.
Well, we're talking right now with Dalton Conley, author of the book Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children. But we're too exhausted to ask. We're talking about the way he's used science and applied it in how he's raised his children and the different outcomes that he's had.
And we want to hear from you. What was your approach to raising children? Did you try to apply the latest science, as our guest has done, to your child-rearing style, or you just kind of wing it? Are there elements of parenting you have questions about? Maybe you want to ask our guest. Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org.
And Dalton, we've been talking about some of the sociological aspects and impulse controls and things like that. What about some of the basics, reading and writing and math, things that we assume our kids are going to need to know to have mastery over their education and to advance? Let's take reading. Are there recommendations about how we should introduce kids to reading?
Well, there is an example of where I kind of went against, you know, what teachers and the educational establishment generally recommends, and instead I followed what I thought was the cutting edge research. So what I did for my own kids, for example, and I'm not advocating, I should say at the outset, this is not an instruction book. This is like a show by example. So you see my examples, you could think I would want to do exactly the opposite of that, or you could, why don't I try that? That's an interesting thing. But really, it's the methodology I want to get across. So in the case of reading, what I knew from the research literature was that it's not really important when kids start to learn to decode the words on the page themselves. So as long as they can do it by the time they're in, you know, first grade or maybe even later, as long as they don't fall too far behind. What is really important is that they understand complex, a lot of words, they have a big vocabulary, and they understand complex sentence structure and syntax. So basically, I you know, left it to the school to teach my kids how to actually read, and I instead just read to them, and we talked about the books, and we, you know, defined words and had interactive reading sessions constantly, but never actually showed them how to, you know, decode the word to sound out the word, you know, cat or hat or what have you, see spot run. In first grade, they were among the lowest testing kids in reading, and it started to panic a little bit about the approach. But by fifth grade, they were at the top of the class, and their verbal ability, their non-reading verbal ability in that whole interim period was always sort of high and off the charts. So in that case, it paid off. But again, if a kid, what the science says is that for each kid, it may be different. So a kid with dyslexia may require actually explicit training on how to decode, visually decode words, but most kids are going to figure it out. And much more important to focus on their understanding and comprehension.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got John on the line from Stevens Point. Hi, John.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been interested in psychology and raising kids. And me and my wife, we have three boys. We have a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And I'm a big fan of Daniel Goleman. He has, you know, that emotional intelligence. And another big fan that I just was wondering if you could comment on this. There's that trying brain theory where we have three parts of our brain. We have the reptilian part that's kind of the, you know, feed, you know, protect our territory. And then we have the mammalian part, which mammals have, like that causes dogs to wag their tails, causes us to feel emotion. And then there's that neocortex, that thinking part that we as humans have that separates us. And something that we've done with our kids is we've realized that our two-year-old is big-time reptilian brain. He wants everything. This is mine. I'm upset if you take it from me. This is my territory. And then with our five-year-old, he's way more emotional. You know, he feels it. And then we're beginning to see in our seven-year-old, he's beginning to take more time to think about it. And one of the things that we've done up to this point is we've really focused on that emotional side and having our kids realize what is the feeling they feel. Are you mad? Are you sad? Are you angry? And so that it's been helping us so far. But, you know, just with kids, as you know, and as I know, having three boys and they're all completely different, it takes a lot of patience. So I was just wondering, you know, if you could just comment on any of that.
All right. Thanks a lot, John. So John's kind of breaking it down by brain science and where he thinks his kids fall in that measure. Did you look at that approach?
I mean, I think everything he said is correct, and it sounds like his kids are each at the right stage where they're supposed to be for their ages. And, you know, there's a lot, there's these two kind of almost complementary or contradictory strands of child developmental science right now. One says that what you do earlier in life, the earlier, the more important. So even prenatally, what kind of nutrition, for example, or the stress level of the mother, and then, you know, infancy, like that the kids form secure attachments with their caregiver, is really the basis of whether even in an adulthood they're going to have successful human relationships, intimate relationships. And so one strand of science is increasingly emphasizing very early life conditions, and the fact that, like, kids' dies are cast by the time they reach kindergarten. For example, class disparities in cognitive functioning in school are already present in kindergarten, basically, and you know, and schools really can't make that up. On the other hand, we're increasingly learning that brain development is a lifelong process, and in fact, there's a good reason that insurance companies are rational, car insurance companies, that is, to give under 25 drivers a higher rate, because really the connections between your emotional brain, as he calls it, the reptilian brain, and your prefrontal cortex is the more kind of sanguine, you know, intellectual aspect that makes good decisions. Those connections aren't truly completely forged until you're really 25. I mean, it's why we, you know, teenagers are the way they are, and so, you know, it is a lifelong and even brain development even occurs after that. Some people argue. So there's different things to do at each stage. I don't cover everything in the book, but it's meant to be kind of a funny dip into the science, and to make it go down easy with kind of funny stories and my own mishaps and so forth.
One of the things you referenced when we started talking was some of the science about perseverance. Another word for it is grit, and that kids who just keep on going are the ones who are going to succeed, as opposed to the kids who quit too early. Did you look at that at all, and how you could maybe, you know, it's one thing to see that research and another thing to instill it in your kid. Did you look at that one at all?
Yeah. So I was always very concerned about that issue, particularly with one kid with ADHD, which is counter to that, obviously. And so one thing I did, which is probably the wrong thing, was that I wanted, I know that math, for example, in terms of shifting to cognitive ability, math is an increasingly important skill in our economy. It's often a weeder subject for a lot of entrants to higher education and so forth. So I really wanted to train my kids in math. So I ended up literally bribing them to do extra math during summers and during school vacations and on weekends. Sometimes money, sometimes video game time, sometimes gummy bears, whatever it was at the right, you know, appropriate ages. And one of the worries about using bribery on your kids is that if you bribe people, this is at least a theory, that you bribe people, then you undermine their intrinsic motivation to do that thing. In fact, like, you know, they will have less desire to do math than they started with after, once I removed the financial incentives. That didn't turn out to be the case in my kids' case, but what did happen was that they then saw, like, everything I would ask them to do in terms of market like, oh, how much do I get if I do it that extra thing?
I'm familiar with that.
We kind of have a little market system now of fines and rewards for different behaviors. Has that ultimately led them to be able to persevere and do things that they wouldn't have done otherwise, or is it kind of screwed up their entire thinking where they no longer can just do something, but and this is my son in particular, but they want to be rewarded for everything? That's that's an open question, I would say, right now. But definitely, at the time, at least, I was focused on, I wanted them to be able to focus on math for longer. And because math is a very demanding, subject that requires that kind of perseverance. Other psychologists I know have argued that you can put a mitten on a kid's right hand, their dominant hand, and make them do things, simple things like open and close the door, brush their teeth, whatever, with their less dominant hand. And just that very act, which requires a kind of consciousness and mental discipline to do it, will actually, help develop the brain's discipline that extends to all tasks.
That's so interesting. And these things, you hear stories like this and little tricks that might help your kid in the long run, they might really help them as they develop. On the other hand, I don't know, did your kids ever get sick and say, Dad, we're not guinea pigs, just leave us alone?
Definitely. In fact, the book ends when they kind of are just starting adolescence, and now they're in high school, and definitely they're in full-fledged insurgency mode and revolt. So I think my experimenting days are over, and now it's more delicate negotiation, or letting them push. The whole parenting strategy has to change, where they have to get their independence, but you also have to provide boundaries and firm foundation. And no, definitely they will not let me. I think their days as guinea pigs or lab rats are over. But when they were really young, they didn't kind of realize what was going on, and it was all for their best interest. And I gave them gummy bears at the end.
Dalton, we only got about a minute left, but one of the things I think you care most about is the best way for a parent to express love. Do you have any words of wisdom about that?
One quote I have in the book is from a psychiatrist that said, nobody is ever on their couch complaining that they got too much love. So you're going to at best be right, slightly more than half the time in your decisions, and in the even if they're informed by science. But I think as long as you are showing, in my case, what I wanted to raise was kids that were inquisitive, that were themselves kind of natural born scientists, and I wasn't obsessed with whether or not they have a perfect GPA or could do 3 hours of violin practice a day, and I think that my love and caring did come through. Through my intense involvement in sort of trying to do the best thing for them from the science. But each parent obviously has their own way of expressing their connection and attachment.
Dalton, thank you so much for coming on and talking today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Dalton Conley, the author of Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children, But Were Too Exhausted to Ask.